Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journey.
If we can put the intellectual capital, the financial capital, the dogged determination to solve a problem, and then we can converge available technologies, you can solve the problem. There are ways if we converge the technologies, and if you have the right business approach to the whole thing, you can still produce all the materials that are needed for any human welfare and any human poverty-related problems at the cheapest cost possible.
It's a great privilege to introduce Mohan Hazhadhu, President and Chief Executive at Help Me See, an American nonprofit providing advanced treatment, surgery, and training to eliminate unnecessary cataract blindness worldwide. Cataract blindness is the leading cause of avoidable blindness worldwide and can be treated with a quick yet safe 5-minute surgical procedure. Help Me See has an extensive and growing network of cataract surgeons practicing in some of the world's poorest communities. By the end of 2013, it had completed 100,000 cataract surgeries through its Help Me See program. Mohan is a passionate, inspiring social entrepreneur.
Tell me a little bit about Help Me See and tell me about your journey and since you've been at the organization and you helped start it, I understand.
Let me start with my journey to begin with. I'm originally from India and born and grew up there and started my early career with a mining company to begin with. Sooner than later, I discovered that that's probably not my best calling, put it that way. I happened to meet one great person, Mr. William Davidson. William Davidson is a legend of my times in that part of the world, in India at that time. He was engaged in agricultural settlements for refugees. There is no other place to learn about entrepreneurship than working with refugees, because refugees come from different countries and different places, and they're completely uprooted, and they are they're like the rice paddies, you know. Particularly when you transplant rice paddies or rice in the paddies, they grow much faster. They're very aggressive and they grow well. Refugee populations are like that because they're just waiting for an opportunity to settle somewhere peacefully and begin to reconstruct their life again. So I had the unique privilege of working with Bill Davidson on refugee settlements in India, and we resettled probably over 250,000-300,000 people, basically small townships of 32 houses each in agriculture, with farming lands around. That is where my baptism in fire for social entrepreneurship come from.
Right. And what was it that inspired you about that kind of work?
First of all, I think it's a combination of the skills of people with whom we are working and discovering their ingenuity to survive and survive well. And the Tibetan refugees in India, they are a story in themselves when they fled from China and moved over the Himalayas and then came over to India. They were working on the road construction projects up in the Himalayas and so on and so forth. And a lot of people perished because of sickness and poverty. And then finally, when we decided to resettle them in agriculture, that was a fresh lease of life for them. And we could find people to do and people to learn anything and everything apart from their traditional craft that they brought in, like carpet weaving and animal rearing and so on and so forth. They were also very adept people in agriculture, so they were very eager to learn. So we could set up, say for example, with the a group of people of say 32 houses in each village, construct the village and then put them into the houses and then give them the farmlands, about 2/3 of an acre for every child and 4/5 of an acre, 2/5 of an acre for every child and 4/5 of an acre for every adult. That's a compensation for the family. And then once you earmark land, they work really, really hard. You had to chase them out of the field in the evening to go and get some meals, because they continue to work all day and all night if they can, and they will never miss a planting season. Basically, I think today it's a successful story where the Tibetan communities in south of India, how they're living and thriving there.
Yes, yes, yes. So you realized that this was this kind of work, working in a social entrepreneurial environment, inspired you and satisfied you in a way that conventional work didn't.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, and tell me then about Help Me See and you know the genesis, the beginning of that.
Well, Help Me See is again a dream of another, I would say, a real entrepreneur in the real successful business venture in training of aircraft pilots who started up flight safety, Al Yochi. He started his business as a young kid from a burger stand to basically teaching flying to the others and then becoming the personal pilot for Juan Trip, the founder of Pan Am. And later on, he set up his own pilot training company, which is Flight Safety. And his passion was flying. And he was passionately involved with every aspect of flying. And he found that safe aviation requires the best trained, well-trained pilots. And that's how he started Flight Safety. And he converted the flight safety organization with the best technology that he could get into in simulation. So simulation-based technologies in the 1950s and 60s were basically mechanical. He evolved that into electronic, and then today, aviation or flying, of course, God forbid, the Malaysian Airways kind of stuff doesn't ever happen. But still, aviation is, or flight is still the most safe form of transportation, thanks to Al Yochi, because he believed in pilot training. Today, Flight Safety trains about 75,000 pilots. And when he set up that whole company, and finally when he sold it to Warren Buffett, he wanted to devote another part of his career and life in really making blindness as a cause that he would like to deal with and solve the problem of blindness in the world. And that's where I started working for him. He brought me to the United States to work for him to kind of figure out a solution for it. With every entrepreneur, it's also very important to have a mentor with whom you can work and make those dreams possible.
Absolutely. And when you looked at this problem, how did you look at it, and how did you develop the idea for Help Me See?
Blindness is the second only most feared situation in your life after death. You know, I mean, to become blind is the worst thing that can happen. So it was a no-brainer that if you can solve one of those fundamental threats to human life, that is something that is worthwhile doing. So the cause is so powerful, and there are solutions to solve the problems. Like more than 60-70% of the blindness in the world is simply not necessary. For those people, it is not necessary to be blind. They are blind simply because they can't access a affordable, high quality surgical procedure for the simple problem or a basic problem of a cataract, which is clouding of the lens. If you grow old if you live too long, or if you live long enough, you will get cataract. And sometimes even there is a congenital issue of cataract blindness. So there is a solution. There is a problem. There is a solution. The question is well-trained surgeons and high-quality surgery available to the poorest of the population. So how do you make that happen? So for me, working with Al Yochi and now his son Jim Yochi, it's a no-brainer to deal with an issue, pushing that towards a solution.
Tell me about the early days then, and you know, some of the challenges getting a project like this off the ground.
Well, the early days of Help Me See, in some ways, I think we tried our best together with Al Yochi and Jim Yochi. We tried our best to convince Orbis, which was founded by Al Yochi. And he donated the planes, and he secured the planes and supported the organization for 25 years. Now, we tried to convince them that they need to move in this direction, and they were simply not interested. They were more interested in the research and evaluation and, you know, advocacy and so on and so forth. So it was a little bit of a setback for us. So when we decided to start Help Me See, again, the entrepreneurial side of it is that the Al Yochi Foundation and the family, both Al and Jim Yochi, their position was that, look, we will do our fair share, but we need to run this as a business. How do you do that? Obviously, you need to find other investing partners or other interested parties to become or join the cause. So that is the initial challenge. On the one hand, you have the security of support from an initial investor. And on the other hand, you need to make it happen with support that you can, once they have done their work, once they are prepared to do their fair share, how do you gather the support for from the general public and in a very significant way?
Right, right. And what made you think that it would be important to be, make money and rather than, you know, be a charity per se?
Well, we are still, we are a not-for-profit.
Yes.
But the way that we run, it is run as a business. It is not run as a usual charitable organization structure. Which essentially means is that we have a very, very direct and strong focus on our customers. And again, this is not to say that charities don't do a good job or anything, but many charities become too much involved in their own processes and internal philosophies and so on and so forth. In our case, we are absolutely and directly focused on the blind person and also the surgeon who does the surgery. We do not have any other institutional biases or anything. So to me, I think the fundamental principle in entrepreneurial philanthropy or social enterprise is to bring that customer focus. And how do you bring the customer focus to the person who is ultimately benefiting from what you do? And how do you structure your program around that? That to me is the kind of most interesting challenge.
Right, absolutely. And in terms then of you obviously working as a team, how important, you mentioned having a mentor, the importance generally of having a mentor, but how important do you think as a social entrepreneur, particularly where you can be working in areas where poor infrastructure, lack of structure, it's, you know, many, many more uncertainties indeed than a contemporary entrepreneur maybe. Presumably, this team and support is crucial.
Absolutely. To me, I think in a social entrepreneurship, you need several things. I think mentor investors. You know, it is not only just mentoring; it's also people who are prepared to put money into the enterprise. You know what I mean? So you need the seed capital. Without the seed capital, you cannot do anything. Capital is fundamental. So you need the capital, you need the support, and at the same time, you also need a composition of or convergence of technologies in order to solve the most difficult problems in this world. If human beings could go to moon with a computer that is smaller than or smaller in terms of capacity than today's cell phone, that speaks to itself, isn't it? We can do tremendous things with so little, but then there are inertias all along the way. So the difficulties that you're talking about, access, knowing where people are, getting the surgeons, these are all problems, but they're not insurmountable. How did we solve the problem of smallpox? Smallpox was a very, very difficult disease. Millions of people got killed and maimed and so on and so forth. But we could find a solution in terms of the vaccine and then get that vaccine out to those people right into the 70s, we had that problem, but in the 80s we solved the problem. If we can put basically the intellectual capital, the financial, intellectual and financial capital, a dogged determination to solve a problem, and then we can converge available technologies, you can solve the problem. That's what is kind of exciting in social entrepreneurship.
That's very positive, inspiring perspective. Thank you for that. In terms of fundraising, I think social entrepreneurs face particular challenges fundraising. Can you talk a little bit about why it's a particular challenge and what insights you have or lessons about how to go about that?
Fundraising will always be a challenge in the sense that you will never have enough resources that you will need to solve a gigantic problems like problem like this. The only way the fundraising challenge can be solved, one of the ways that I think it can be solved, is by constant leveraging. And one of the fundamental philosophies that I have in my life, and again, I think that's why I call myself a social entrepreneur, I don't think nobody is rich enough not to receive, and nobody is poor enough not to give. Everybody can leverage whatever resources that they have if they have the determination to solve a particular problem. But obviously, that determination is the most important thing. I have seen in the surgical clinics that we support in Nepal and so on and so forth, families who travel 300 miles and probably walk over 10, 15 miles to get to a clinic and get their eye surgery done. They may not have any money, but they have the doggedness, the determination to solve their own problem. So to me, it is leveraging the capability, leveraging the advantages of technology in such a manner that there is a role for everyone to play, and we can leverage their commitment and resources to solve the problem. So in terms of fundraising, if you took a problem like eliminating cataract blindness, in my estimation, it might cost about $4.5 to $5 billion worldwide. That is based on the assumption that there are about 22 million people who are bilaterally blind needlessly due to cataract, and each surgery will cost anything between, say, $30 to $50. And the child surgeries will cost about $350. Now, if you went with that as a portfolio to anybody, particularly even in the developed world, they'll say, that's too much money that anybody can have. Nobody can do it. But when you break that into pieces and then say, okay, if you took that $4.5 billion or $5 billion, 60 to 70 million surgeries is what we need to deliver. And in order to deliver those surgeries, how much is required, what is required, and where it is required, and then you can kind of say, all right, we can begin to leverage some of the monies required for this whole program and leverage the resources required right from the place where the problem needs to be solved. Like I was in Africa traveling in the last few months, speaking to every single country government, and once they see that there is a solution for it, is a simple act like declaring cataract surgery as essential surgery and integrated to the primary healthcare program itself. If a surgery does cost about, say, $50, I can easily see a third of that cost coming from the country itself. And again, it's a question of making it affordable.
Yes, yes, yes.
The procedure is affordable, and it's a high-quality procedure. Another example, there is tremendous waste that is happening, particularly in the surgical delivery system, because that's what I'm focused on at the moment. Look at it this way. I was in Yamoussoukro, the capital city of Cote d'Ivoire. In Yamoussoukro, a nice surgeon charges today $200 to $220 equivalent in order to perform a cataract surgery with just the cataract lens being removed with no intraocular lens implanted. Can you imagine that? Now, we can get the surgical supplies needed for the same surgery with the intraocular lens, with a non-suturing, non-sutureless manual small incision surgery for not more than $50. these poor people are paying way beyond their means and ability for a procedure which should cost only 1/4 of what they are asked to pay today.
Yes, yes, it's shocking.
It's shocking, but it is real. I'm not making this up at all. These numbers are all absolutely real. So our goal is, in coming to social entrepreneurship, leveraging, finding cost efficiencies, and getting high quality products and procedures at the lowest cost possible. And it is possible to do it. Like, we started off an idea with disposable surgical kits, because one of the problems in basic surgeries, as you know, is that the contamination is a problem, complications is a problem, infections coming out of poorly sterilized equipment and so on and so forth. Say, for example, I was in the Gambia traveling around. In the Gambia, they said, look, they had a big central sterilization system where they brought all the surgical tools to a central location in the Gambia. Gambia is a small country. They brought every day or every 2-3 days all the surgical tools that they use in the villages into the central surgical sterilization unit, where they had big autoclaves, and they sterilized and repackaged it and sent it in vans to the local clinics. But you know, the fact is that by the time these surgical equipment, sterilized ones, reach the local clinics, it's already contaminated with all the fine dust that gets into the whole thing. We said, look, why don't we have a pre-sterilized single-use kit? Great idea. Started discussing with the best suppliers in the world. I don't want to name companies or anything. And we went to them, the best producer. They said, in the Europe, we are already doing it. It will cost about $300 to $400 a kit. Okay, we started with that. Said, fine. So we sat with our medical team and our chief medical officer and the others. We said, okay, standardize the whole kit. Rationalize all the supplies that are needed. We don't want to kind of take away any item out, which is absolutely essential. At the same time, we don't want to oversupply stuff. But at the same time, once you take the kit, it should be adequate to do the entire process of the surgery. So they standardized the kit. Then we sourced that whole kit all around the world, including in China, in India, in different places. Today I'm signing a purchase order for a very high quality, single-use, pre-sterilized, gamma-sterilized kit, which will withstand for 3 to 6 months excuse me, in terms of its shelf life. I can do it for $31.50.
Wow, that's an extraordinary reduction in the price. What's the lesson there, Mohan?
The lesson there is that there are ways, if you converge the technologies and if you have the right business approach to the whole thing, you can still produce all the materials that are needed for any human welfare and any human poverty-related problems at the cheapest cost possible. It is possible. That's in a very cost-efficient way possible.
Yes.
In communities where people can afford only a dollar a day income, or communities with a dollar a day income or $2 a day income, they can put something into that and then make it affordable for them.
So this idea is of a partnership. I mean, getting these cost savings, you probably need to be quite determined when you're negotiating with people.
Absolutely. Every small step of the way.
So there's a determination to take each step, break down a problem into its elements, and optimize each little piece and push to get as good a deal and as you can.
Yeah, you need to deal at the individual pieces level and at the aggregate level and bring the convergence of technologies.
And
for example, gamma sterilization is very safe and so on and so forth, but then how do you make sure that the gamma sterilization is done right? How do you make sure that it is cost effective? You need to kind of work at technology level as well as at the individual pieces level to make it cost efficient.
Yes, yes. Now, just to change gear a little bit, just briefly, social entrepreneurship is a growing area, covers many different kinds of organizations, I suppose. What do you think needs to happen for this to continue to develop and grow and reach its potential?
When you say, reach its potential, I feel that the potential is already there, and it's a question of when you say potential, you know, the way that you ask that question, it kind of takes a position that maybe the social entrepreneurship is not grown enough, or it is not reached its full potential. I feel that I have a little bit of a contrarian view. It's a view that human beings are very, very ingenuous. If you are able to get social entrepreneurship as an idea, that it can work, that it can yield results, and if you can get a I would say massive number of people committed to that whole thing, then it will begin to yield much more results. To me, I don't think it is a lack of capital. It is not. I think there is enough money for everybody. Is it a lack of supplies or lack of technology? I don't think so, because technology will always be there if you have the determination. It's a question of putting the right pieces together.
Yes, and I think are you also suggesting that communication is important? Because once you start to look into this, and I'm looking at interviewees for this podcast, you realize what a vast number of amazing, inspiring projects, social entrepreneurs and social businesses and hybrid businesses that are out there, and the wide range of problems that they are dealing with very effectively. Yet, that's not something that's always apparent.
That's a good point. I think it needs to be communicated. It needs to be lessons can be learned from all over the place. And you'll also hear about enough number of failed experiments or failed entrepreneurships or failed enterprises. You have also lessons to learn from that too. It is not just the successes that need to be communicated, but also the failures.
Yes, yes. What keeps you going, Mohan? Have there been difficult times in this project, in this business?
That's what I was going to say. Look, as much as there are successes that I can get inspired about, I also know that there are so many failures that could happen. Many failures that I myself am aware of, in the sense that even working in working with some of the communities in, say for example, war-torn countries and so on and so forth, it's not always an easy thing to do. It's not always easy to get things done. So there are always limitations to that. Look at the whole fight against polio. Every time we think that we have solved the problem, suddenly it crops up in some place or the other because of social or cultural or those kind of issues. Yes, there are failures too, in that sense that we cannot get the consensus of the world in a direction to solve a particular problem. It's not always a singular path.
What keeps you going? Who inspires you, Mohan?
As I said, I was very fortunate in my life. In all my career, I had excellent mentors, from Bill Davidson, who was doggedly determined to resettle all the refugees in agriculture and earn their own livelihood and become successful citizens, to Al Yochi and his vision about how technology and simulation can solve a problem of surgical training, and then how that can lead into solutions. So once you get that kind of a strong, mentorship, it's not easy to get out of it. You know, you get so determined to make that happen.
Absolutely. And for anyone who wants to follow in your footsteps, as it were, what advice would you give them?
I would say seek your passion, look for your mentors, and mentors who can support not only financially but also with the ideas. To me, it is not all. It's not. I wouldn't say that nothing is about money. Yes, there is something about money, but it's not all about money. It's all about. It's mostly about ideas and ideas that can work, and you're getting passionate about it.
Fantastic. That's very inspiring, Mohan. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.